Steve Sherlock with another Franklin Matters radio show. This session of the radio show shares my conversation with Ted McIntyre, Franklin resident and climate activist. We recorded this via the Zoom conference bridge on February 1, 2022. We completed our coverage of the 12 points of the mass legislation passed in 2021 that we started in our first episode. If you have climate questions or Franklin-specific climate questions, send them in and we'll try to answer them in a future session. This particular recording runs about 45 minutes, so let's listen to my conversation with Ted McIntyre as we make sense of climate. Steve Sherlock for Franklin Matters, Franklin Public Radio, WFPR.FM, anywhere on the internet, and 102.9 on the local area Franklin Mass FM dial for another Making Sense of Climate session with good buddy and climate expert, Ted McIntyre. Ted, how are you doing this fine Tuesday post-blizzard?
I have survived the blizzard of 22, and I'm feeling pretty chuffed about the whole thing, and happy to be here.
Happy to be here, yes. My snow thrower, I won't say what kind of it is, it worked for me nicely. I was able to do a bunch of shoveling as well, so I saved some of the carbon that way. But, you know, you got to fight fire with fire, to that extent at least. So that's probably
system change.
The poor metaphor. But for those who hadn't heard, we're going to make some sense of climate. For those who perhaps would want to, we did do one other episode and we started down a path. There was a WBUR article that you had referenced that we had said 12. It's actually 13 points came out of the mass government legislation that went through the House, Senate, and Governor Baker finally signed off on. We touched on about four last time, so I figured we'd just jump in again, cover some of the others, and it sounds like we may still have another session behind that, and I'm ready to pick up on your point using the carbon term. Let's go for a toboggan ride. Let's see where the sleds can take us.
Yeah, well, it's a reminder that there's a law passed in like March of 2021, just a year or so ago now, called the Next Generation Roadmap for Climate Change here in Massachusetts. And that is sort of a visionary legislation that has both sort of concrete milestones and goals and a lot of aspirational stuff that we need to build out with other legislation, right? So this is a beginning, but it's good to know what's in the initial package. And we should remember that there's this bill, which is now Massachusetts state law. Mm-hmm. And in parallel to that, not quite in the same time frame, but quite theoretically quite parallel, there were roadmaps, just sort of white paper documents given out by the Baker administration as well. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of correspondence, but the law takes precedence. And as we said, the law last time we discussed, the law sets quite ambitious goals for achieving significant greenhouse gas reductions by the years 2030 and 2050, which are, you know, a 30-year time frame. And again, just greenhouse gases basically are anything that causes global warming. In particular, we're talking about carbon dioxide, which comes from almost anything you burn, but in particular, burning fossil fuels like natural gas and because we're probably going to touch on it today, let me just say another very potent greenhouse gas is methane, which is sold to you as something called natural gas, but the chemical name is methane. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that methane is a much, much more potent greenhouse gas than is carbon dioxide, but has a shorter lifetime in the atmosphere, right, to confuse things. But long and short of it, yeah, methane is much more potent greenhouse gas. We keep emitting it, and we'll come back to that. So yeah. Anyway, the law very correctly sets high-level milestones for absolute reduction of emissions, which is a good thing. But there's other stuff that it did, right? And we can talk to those. One of the things that it did was to basically, if you're trying to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from burning natural gas, you have to talk about what's called the built environment, in quotation marks, right? The built environment is houses, your Home Depot, right? The school, everything that's built that people live in, right?
The biggest chunk of that, the world that exists today, not just what we can do going forward, but we also have to do something with where we are today.
Where we are today, but in a sense, because the timeline of the roadmap extends out to 3050, part of the wisdom says anything that we build in the year 2022 is probably still going to be standing in the year 2050. Mm-hmm. And we know that in the year 2050, there can't be any greenhouse gases. We can't be burning natural gas to heat a home in the year 2050. So why should we allow those homes to be built today and then be retrofitted at great expense sometime between now and 2050? And that's what brings us to building codes. Again, mm-hmm. As we mentioned last time, building codes are sort of a dry topic because it's about how do you build your stairs, right? What's mm-hmm. the width of the tread versus the rise of the tread, all that kind of stuff.
The rise and the run.
But it's also can be thought of in terms of saying that you cannot build a house, a code that says you can't build a house if you use natural gas, or you must build your house that is only uses electric. And that's mm-hmm. something embodied in something called a net zero stretch code. And this law, rewinding all the way back to the roadmap, said that the state government must release a model building code that embodies this net zero idea of no gas, electrification only. State has to release a building code, and that individual towns can then opt in to choosing to use that. Because right? mm-hmm. there's a lot of pressure in different towns across the state to, get off gas and change it. But so the bill wisely says, here's the best code going. Your town can opt into it. And so then what that does is, interesting enough, is it pushes the responsibility down to grassroots organizers in different towns who mm-hmm. can go and demand that the stretch code be accepted.
Right, and thence into the developers who would then be having to abide by that set of legislation in order to do, or zoning in particular, in order to do, whether it's an individual house or a retail operation or an office complex or whatever.
Right, right. And I think there's an estimate I saw, I think it was this morning, I saw something that said half of the buildings standing today will still be standing in 2050. Right? Mm. But conversely, half of the buildings that will exist in 2050 will have been built between now and then.
Right.
So that chunk of the buildings we ought to make clean, right? So there you go.
So it at least enables, or at least has some forethought to say, well, obviously change is not going to happen overnight. So let's start doing some things rather than forcing the buildings to be built in this new thing tomorrow, in one, the code's not even there. Maybe some of the builders and maybe some of that technology is not even there. Let's just at least start doing things to get better before going further.
Absolutely, absolutely. So there's that chunk. And I would just say this net zero building code is a particular interest of mine because the organization that I volunteer with, the Massachusetts Climate Action Network, is aggressively pushing that building code. And there's a whole universe of stuff underneath that, how to do that and why it matters and what the politics of it are. But it's an important segment of the discussion. Mm-hmm. Another thing that the roadmap legislation enshrined into law is a change of the priority for the Department of Public Utilities. And again, this is something that everyone's eyes roll back in their head when you start talking about some of this stuff because it's so mundane, right? But the state has a Department of Public Utilities, which is an organization that essentially oversees Eversource and the electrical utilities, okay?
Well, and historically, they tend to come up, at least as I recall, in the news and in the hot seat. Maybe not a good pun, but they're the ones who approve the rate increases that the utilities come up with when they come before them. So they do have a significant role. It sounds absolutely. Like that role is being expanded to say, oh, by the way, do more.
Yeah, I mean, the electrical generation and gas delivery, right? But let's just say the electrical generation is a highly regulated industry, right? The utility, people should know this, the utilities are given a monopoly by the state of Massachusetts to be the only people that provide power, right? And then literally electrical power, right? And in exchange for that monopoly on your dollar, they have to go to the state to ask for permission to raise prices, to do almost anything, okay? Over the decades, since all this was formulated in the 1910s and 20s, right? Back then in the 10s and 20s, what they wanted was reliability of the power and affordability of the power, everything else be damned, right? But now in the age of climate change and rethinking this business model of giving a monopoly to the utility, what the new law says is that the Department of Public Utility has to, in addition to taking safety, reliability, and affordability of the electric supply, they have to consider that, but they also have to consider general security, equity, that is to say, in environmental justice communities, and reducing greenhouse gas emissions in the electric grid. So these are new priorities that the DPU has, and that's a big change, especially because the DPU historically, so this is just my opinion, it's kind of a captured thing, right? Even though since 1910, the DPU has been around regulating the utilities, of course, the main job of the utilities is to take over the DPU and have their friends sitting on the DPU, right? So it's kind of captured and very, very sympathetic to what the utilities want to do, blah, 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 blah. So anyway,
while they focused on the dollar side, oh, you can go up 2% versus 5%. They never really looked at the source of where that was coming from. And it sounds like now they're actually being forced to consider the source to be less fossil fuel, more wind, more solar, more renewable, whatever it is.
Right. They have to take that into account in making decisions. So, for example, in another of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network's campaigns, there's this what's called a peaker plant, an electrical generating facility in Peabody, right, that will emit carbon dioxide into an environmental justice area. And that was all approved before June of last year, right? So now the new rules say, hey, you guys should have included in environmental justice and carbon dioxide emissions in your granting permission to have that thing be built. So another thing that's quite impressive and impactful, and again, it's hidden in the jargony weeds of the whole thing, right? But the roadmap, there is this concept called a renewable portfolio standard, RPS. You'll see the acronym RPS stands for renewable portfolio standard. The renewable portfolio standard is this concept that says, again, through the Department of Public Utilities and the state, they can tell the utilities to say, each year you will increase how much renewable energy you give us by a certain percentage, right? So that's the standard. The renewable portfolio standard is each year you're going to have X percentage more of clean electricity than you did last year. And this has been going on now for maybe 10 or 15 years at the 1% level. Each year, the utility has to be 1% more clean. Under the new roadmap bill, the renewable portfolio standard says your clean energy, again, the state looks at the utility and says, Mr. Utility, you will provide us 3% more clean energy this year than you did last year. And next year, it's going to be another 3%. And the year after that, it's another 3%. Mm-hmm. So it's a virtuous cycle by calling for this aggressive RPS. I mean, the way I've been putting it to myself, if you made an investment in your 401k and you get 3% a year guaranteed forever, that grows fairly quickly, right?
Yeah, so doubles over 7 years or something like that.
Exactly. And since we need to get to 100% by 2030, 3% a year gets us a long way there by commanding the utilities to do that. So and I would just say in passing, at the federal level, there was something equivalent called the Clean Energy Purchase Program. But again, it was a demand for increasing clean energy in the federal level. Mm-hmm. And that got nixed by some guy from West Virginia. I forget his name, but I mean, that's not...
Yeah, coal country. Go figure.
So there's the renewable portfolio standard. The annual percentage increase is increased to 3%. And that's a very good thing in this new landmark legislation for the roadmap. Okay. Another thing, and this is an interesting because it's that the law now allows the utilities to be a little bit more creative in what they do and to explore new technologies. Last week, we talked about micro geothermal districts, where instead of pumping gasoline into your house, the utility is providing, you know, constant temperature water that makes your heat pump work really well.
Mm-hmm.
So the bill encourages that sort of experimentation at the utility scale, which is great. But the interesting thing that goes further than that is that we said before, many of these portions of the climate roadmap law need to be expanded. There is yet another bill in front of the state legislature called the Future of Heat. Okay, Future of Heat is the name of the bill. I can find but inside that bill, it turns out that the utilities need to be explicitly given permission to sell anything other than natural gas. So if they're going to sell you hot propylene glycol or water or something that comes into your house at 50 degrees, they have to be given legal permission to do that.
Well,
so there's another bill there to make that happen.
Yeah. To the extent that I think it goes back to clearly the legislation was established back in 1910 or whatever, the utility was provisioned to have the monopoly on delivering a single source. And now we're saying, oh, by the way, you need to be creative to give us renewable pieces. So, yeah, we're going to have to go back and change the legislation. You can't just give me natural gas or methane or whatever. You can give me something else as long as it's, quote, classified as renewable or whatever, I would assume.
I think that an even bigger question there is whether or not the business model for the utilities that was established at basically the turn of the century when electrification was just going. I mean, I remember reading about the Tennessee Valley Authority, right, where they were providing, you know, this is a great New Deal thing, providing. I mean, that business model is no longer relevant to the 21st century, right? It's just different, and we should have different. The question is, should all of our electricity be provided to us by essentially a private profit-making institution, right? The utilities, again, the utilities are called the IOUs, investor-owned utilities. That is to say, it's a company. It's traded on the stock market. You get a dividend if you own stock in these utilities.
True.
But it's your public money that's guiding it. And so now the interest in getting a profit for the shareholders overrides the good to the general public. Right? Is that a model you want to live with?
Well, and just I think at least back to the TVA, Tennessee Valley days, to the extent that they were able to, as a quasi-government entity, harness the rivers and the lakes and build the dams to create the water power, to create the electricity, at that time, that makes sense. Because they were able to do so, at least, you know, in those days, relatively cleanly. Water power is still a good generation tool. So,
I mean, it is under, I mean, you worry about what the salmon are going to do to make baby salmon and that kind of thing. But yes, hydropower is clean, right, from a carbon perspective. Yep. I mean, I think last time we talked a little bit about one of the provisions that of the roadmap law. Keep in mind what we're talking about is sort of specific little items underneath this general Massachusetts Next Generation Roadmap for Climate Bill.
The Baker's Dozen, it turns out to be, pun intended, on the Baker piece. We talked about 12 initially and it's 13, which is the Baker's Dozen, but Governor Baker also signed off on it. So.
Absolutely. But one of the topics we touched on last week was this idea that municipal light plants, or MLPs, which are localized, sort of, again, a business model that dates back to the 1890s. I think the first MLP was established in Wellesley in 1896, right? So it goes way, way back. Mm-hmm. They are being brought into the fold and those MLPs are now expected to also abide by the green energy requirements that the big utilities are.
Right.
Another thing that's changed is that the there's an organization called Mass Save,
Yes.
You probably heard of, you may have seen it on the billboards when you go up Route 93. It's mm-hmm. a funny kind of thing because it's got three S's in a row when you're in the logo, right? MASSSAVE, Mass Save.
Yeah.
But for people who don't know, Mass Save is something, is a program that offers what's called an energy assessment. They used mm-hmm. to call it an audit, but that scared people, right? Energy assessment to see how energy efficient is your home, okay? And the wherewithal, the financial backing to offer that sort of energy assessment to individual homes comes because everyone pays a few pennies a month on their electricity bill into a fund that supports that. You can dig out your...
whether it's a national grid statement or whatever you have, utility-wise, there's a charge that is associated with that Mass Save payment. Yep.
Right. In the past, Mass Save has been, I've had it done. In fact, I plan to do it again because I'm thinking of having some more work done here. But the Mass Save will assess your house, tell you where you're leaking, say, oh yeah, you better think about it. You might want mm-hmm. to think about a new furnace, et cetera, et cetera. But what they've done is what the bill does is to change the priorities a little bit of Mass Save from just thinking about energy efficiency to also reducing carbon dioxide emissions,
right,
which in many senses are very tightly linked, but not always identically.
Right.
And so Mass Save is focused on, right. So for example, here you go. What Mass Save, if you have the audit done and you say, oh yeah, my gas heater is 25 years old, right? And they say, well, you know, you might want to think about preparing for that. So here's where the difference is. Instead of saying, let's buy you another really efficient gas heater, they're going to say, oh yeah, you know, you ought to think about a heat pump.
Right.
And that's going to cut your gas emissions over the year. And what's wonderful about that, they'll offer rebates. So the money you're spending doesn't just go to these audits. It also goes to rebates for upgrading stuff. And the best time to upgrade a fossil fuel infrastructure in your home, the infrastructure being your gas heater, mm-hmm. the best time to do is that when you've gotten all the financial benefit and you've worn out that gas heater and it's ready to, you know, go meet its maker, you have to have a new heating system. Okay, that's when you put in a electrified heat pump kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I've had at least one Mass Save assessment prior, maybe two, because I know you can do them every period, every some number of years, right. But it's three or four, I forget exactly. But also in one of the conversations I had with our rep, Jeff Roy, just before Thanksgiving, if I recall correctly, we also talked about Mass Save because I was thinking that at least my next one would be when, you know, because they're part of their incentive is to develop the programs to start incentivizing the heat pumps. And it sounds like they're almost there, but they're not quite there. So I'll wait a little bit and find out when they do that. That'll be my next one. But I think given that, at least from my own situation, I had changed the furnace in 2008, 2009. So yeah, we went from an older style oil to a newer efficient, and I did see the usage considerably drop. Mm-hmm. And then with all the other, you know, insulation, et cetera, we had our windows. Quick comment to the windows, especially with the wind blowing on the blizzard, between the screening and the window, I've got snow piled up and it's still there a couple of days later. I don't recall seeing that even in days when you'd have a crack on the old storm windows, you know, the kind of the windows you'd mm-hmm. hang on. They were just mm-hmm. kind of like snug, but they never really had a proper seal. That went once the sun came out, that snow would melt away. Right, to the extent that the snow is still there between the screen and the window, that says the window itself is maintaining the heat inside the house, which that's a good thing.
That's a good thing. I mean, physics is a remarkable teacher. I was going to say, if you see a house, it's interesting. If you see a house that is has lots of icicles hanging around it on a cold day, right? That's a sure sign that the house is not well insulated because all the heat from the house is going up and melting the snow on the roof, which then drips down into big icicles. And it's, you know, all you're doing is melting the water again. Mm-hmm. It's also true if you walk around and look at houses and you see after kind of a snowfall, you see the remnant snow sort of following the roof joists.
Yes.
Right. It means that between the joists, the heat's coming up and melting the snow, but at the joists, it just can't quite get as much heat. So you see these patterns, right? So mm-hmm. you can tell if you got a problem, right? You can walk and MassSave will help. And in fact, it is the I think it's a good mechanism to even think about converting millions of homes. Because we here in Massachusetts, if we want to achieve the goals, we need to convert something like a million homes a year from gas or oil to heat pumps. And you know, the joke is that I guess in 2021, they converted 456 homes, right, out of a million. Right? Like, so somebody's going to step up to the plate, right? Right.
Not quite there. But while we're on that, I think we shared, we saw in via the social, Framingham starting a pilot on that geothermal district concept. That I think is really exciting.
It's really cool. And I learned from seeing that video, thank you for sending it, was that they're proposing instead of water, they would be pumping a closed loop of ethylene glycol, which I guess is pretty much radiator fluid.
Okay.
Right? And they said environmentally friendly. Who knows? Ethylene, I mean, glycol is sugar, right? I guess I'm not much of a chemist, but I don't think it's not ethyl methyl death they're pumping around, right? But it's not water either.
It doesn't sound like, it sounds like more of an inert, and that might not be the right term for a liquid. They're inerts are usually for gases, if I remember my science days. Not flammable, at least, or dangerous.
Right. So, but you're right. It's a fascinating you know, you look at it and your imagination gets fired up because it's a path to by neighborhood, as we said last week, neighborhood by neighborhood, these big conversions and make some progress. I mean, one of the other, so again, there's this long TikTok of things that are in the Massachusetts Next Generation Roadmap. One of the other things that's in there is a topic that I find interesting for a lot of reasons, but the topic is electric vehicle usage and charging stations.
Yes.
Okay. And so the bill calls for selling more electric vehicles in the state up to the year. Because I mean, you think of it, if a car has a 15-year lifetime, then if you don't want any more cars burning gasoline in 2050, you got to stop selling cars in 2035. Right. And if you want to stop selling gas engine cars in 2035, you better be ramping up electric vehicles starting now. And one way to make it more palatable or to reduce what's called range anxiety, that is to say, my battery's going to die in the middle of the blizzard.
How far can I go? Where am I going to get to?
Right. They want to set up more and more charging stations all around the state. So there's a plan in here to have increased charging stations. Fine.
Yeah, in the Franklin area, at least I know the town has worked to, because of their own electric fleet, they've got some charging stations behind the municipal buildings, so they're kind of out of sight. But the Big Y, and I believe the other retail facility, has charging stations in them now. They also added them at the train station lots. And the library has a couple. So there are increasing charging stations around, and clearly more will be needed and more are at least on the planning books to come. I have two hybrid vehicles, so I don't need a charging station. It kind of recharges as it goes, but you know, that's my, if you will, mitigation step. get it before going fully electric vehicle.
Oh yeah, that's well, so here's the fly in the ointment from my perspective, right? So I think urging the adoption of EVs, and electric vehicle charging stations, that's all good, right? But if you take a deep breath and think about it, what the imagination behind the idea suggests that we are all going to roll into a future where everyone has a car just like they have today, except that it's electric. And we're all going to get on the Mass Pike. We're going to have a traffic jam of electric vehicles because we all still have to drive into downtown. That nothing changes except the internal combustion engine goes away. And I guess my, for several reasons, I think that's not the wisest imagination. I mean, it, what we need to do is think differently, right? The idea that everyone should have an electric vehicle has certain implications, and really, I mean, in, not the simplest being that electric vehicles are fine if you have the money to buy one. But if you live, if you're a disadvantaged person who can't buy an electric vehicle, you're getting screwed. Mm-hmm. So the electric vehicle stuff has to go in tandem with improved public transportation that uses electricity, right?
And in fact, it's, along with that, I would posit that it's not just a rethinking of public transit. Clearly, that has to be part of the solution. But I think we also need to rethink about, particularly in light of the pandemic, I think most major companies at least are now coming around to, if not accepting, remote work in some cases, clearly is a way to go. That's an option. There will always be some people, because of the nature of the work, delivery services, manufacturing workers, they can't go remote. Totally understand that. But for all the office workers, they can be almost anywhere. As long as they've got power, as long as they've got a connection, as long as they have access to the system, they can do what they need to do. And I think the pandemic has shown that companies can do very well that way, as opposed to some managers who before didn't. So then now it gives us an opportunity to rethink how we have our neighborhoods. You know, for those of us who grew up in major cities, we had the corner stores. Now we have the supermarkets. Perhaps coming back to that neighborhood concept. And for anybody who's traveled to Europe, all of the major cities in Europe, right? They all have the neighborhoods. They really don't have a car structure and they're successful. We need to incorporate that in whatever ways make sense. So in a Franklin scenario, I know even in North Park, and I live along King Street, North Park, there's a residence where there had been a corner store at some point in time in the neighborhood. Along Lincoln Street, clearly the Dacey's Market was kind of the corner store. Those are two quick, easy ones that come to mind. There are others in the different neighborhoods of Franklin. If we develop those, which again goes back to zoning, and oh, by the way, I'll put a plug in because there is a major zoning effort discussion around rezoning downtown. So stay tuned for that, get involved in that. There's a whole bunch going on. And oh, by the way, it's related to this. Some of those zoning changes are going to have to be made because to put more retail positions around, call it Dacey's, you'd have to change the zoning in order to do so because it's primarily residential.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, that's why I say, I mean, the implications of this stuff of climate discussion and even this roadmap begs for all sorts of big sort of brain busting questions about how do you build Franklin? How do you build Boston? I mean, you say that
rebuild. We're already built. We don't have a lot of open space to really get into.
As you say, some people have to go to work, right? And so you think of the people at a hospital, right? They need public transportation, right? So a lot of people are privileged and blessed enough to be able to work from home. Those who aren't need the same fair shake and need which is why there's so many interesting articles. There was one about how making MBTA free is the right thing to do. And that's a whole show in and of itself, right? But I mean, I guess the other thing about the electric vehicles, I would just say, and again, where are we? We get the roadmap that was passed last March. This is a bill. What that bill does is encourage the use of electric vehicles and building more charging stations, right? The implication being that we should all have an electric car, right? Which then leads to a discussion about what's my town actually like? If I don't want an electric vehicle, how can we make that fair? What are we going to do, right? But then beyond that is the idea that suddenly, because everyone has an electric vehicle, the demand for the kind of specialty metals that go into the battery skyrockets. Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, the king of Saudi Arabia becomes irrelevant But who, whatever weird place is sitting on top of lithium or cobalt, which happens to be Peru and Congo, right? They're not weird, right? But I mean, they're different. They all of a sudden become kingmakers in places they get fought over. And the question is whether or not, I mean, the question is, I've heard it posed, is whether or not you, as an American, say Ted McIntyre living in Franklin, do I deserve an electric vehicle? Am I entitled to that electric vehicle if, in fact, I'm ruining the life of someone in Peru whose whole habitat is being destroyed to get to the lithium? Right? Those are questions that go way beyond the Massachusetts roadmap, but they're fascinating questions, right?
They are. And that's one of the reasons we're having fun doing this toboggan slide ride, because at some of these bumps and the turns and the conversations, we could go off potentially for an hour in some of these other directions.
I mean, it goes back to the question of how all-encompassing climate is, right? Climate as a topic, right? It just, because literally it touches everything in your life. And that's what makes it both intimidating and interesting, I guess, at the same time. So we're closing in, all right? The item 12 of our 13 in the roadmap bill, what they're calling out is something that they're calling for more solar power, right? And of course, the state wants to build more solar power, right? Again, this has lots of little cul-de-sacs we can pull into here. Mm-hmm. But the news of, so what happened in the bill, in this great roadmap bill, the legislature said, by jingo, we're going to double the size of a program called SMART, which is Solar Massachusetts Renewable Technology or something. Okay. They're going to make it provide rebates for people to put solar panels on their roof. Existing program, they said, all right, this is great. Let's double it. You know, bang, bang, bang. We'll get lots more people to put solar panels on their roofs. Mm-hmm. It went to a state agency called the Department of Energy Resources, DER, right? DER took a year to screw around before they released the new rules to allow this SMART program to begin. So I can send you the link. Just happened this past week after a year of messing around. And this is for a well-established program, right? So it's in the bill, more solar panels, but the execution of that is getting slow-walked. For whatever reason, because everyone's got an interest in the anxiety producing news is that if we say, gee, we were going to have to retrofit 1 million homes a year with heat pumps, just imagine the kind of regulatory delay that could come in approving that program. So
the dominoes can be staggering when I start thinking about it. Yes, so I try not to. But one other piece, clearly there's also an awful lot of talk about wind and the wind power and the wind technology delivery services, with specifically as Mass. And I think there was a host of folks, including our state rep, made a visit to, I think it was Salem last week, to another exploration around wind power, et cetera. And yet in this law, it says solar power. So clearly we're not putting all our eggs in one basket. We've got them in a few baskets going forward.
And that's an interesting buzzword. I mean, we talk about one of the virtues of a energy grid is not to be too dependent on any single fuel source, right? Mm-hmm. And right now we are, historically, Massachusetts was dependent on oil heat for all of our home heating. And now we're much more dependent on natural gas, again, methane gas, but now methane heats our homes and generates the electricity. So if there's some disruption in the gas supply, it's bad. On the other hand, under renewables, if you have solar panels and wind, you have these two pretty much complementary ways of generating electricity, and they're not both likely to go out at the same time. So you're feeling better. Mm-hmm. Right?
you got some resiliency, you got some redundancy built into that, and that is all good, and sustainable. Absolutely.
Yeah. And that brings me back to something I was thinking about with the blizzard of 2022, right? We're sitting here. I, thank God, did not lose my power.
Yes.
My sister down in the South Shore lost power for a little while, but then got it back, right? But here's just the nugget of an idea that unto itself is a whole another hour-long discussion. But if you're imagining as a climate activist, a world in which everyone has an electric vehicle for a car, everyone heats their home with electricity. That means you just need more raw electricity because you have to replace the energy of the gasoline and the natural gas, right? You need more electricity to begin.
Power doesn't necessarily change, but the distribution, the kilowatt hours come from whatever the BTU or equivalents were.
Right. So you need that electricity, but the point of the blizzard is that in the future, the storms are going to be more intense, right? That's where we're headed. And so if you're in a world where your car and your home heating are electrified and the electrical power goes out, you are in a bad place, right? So the state needs to begin to make the whole grid more resilient. And I think an obvious one in rural areas is to just bury the damn power lines, forgive my French, right? Just bury the lines. Yeah. But you can also think about local battery storage. There are things called micro districts, like where the hospital has its own solar panel and storage, and it can be cut off from the main grid, but the hospital is still powered, right? Sure. And all those kinds of things are necessary. The time to begin thinking about it is now, again, because 2030 is not that far away. And we're talking, so there's.
Yeah. And I think related to that, I know since Franklin had, at least for a number of years, it's gradually improved, but certainly National Grid and others were having issues around the power quality. And we were into a whole bunch of, you know, power outages. They were frequent, et cetera. I know my particular area, if they finally did some work at the station nearby, that resolved stuff. I know there was a whole host, even I think it was a year ago, or end of 20, maybe even end of 19, where National Grid came to the town council. They were doing some tree work because a lot of the issues were tree branches were dropping lines, etc. There's always going to be the squirrel that, you know, chews on the wrong thing and fries, and etc. But they've at least been making a whole lot of progress on their infrastructure, their grid alternatives, so that they can cut off a little section and then reroute everybody else. Right. That's part of the work that they need to do, in addition to, oh, by the way, clearing the trees, et cetera, et cetera. But the other piece that caught my eye over some of the football games that we happened to be watching, you know, people at the time certainly had a lot of, you know, backup generators. Now you could potentially use your vehicle to plug back into the house and run the car to run the house. It's like, that would be possible.
You can buy a battery, right? There are battery storage things. They have the solar panel on the roof and a little battery in the garage. And that between that and the electric vehicle, yeah, you could go for days. But I guess the question of increasing the amount of solar power and talking about wind and making the grid more resilient, that connects to the final and 13th point that we wanted to make, is that the whole roadmap talks about jobs. Yes. Right. So all that sort of resiliency work, I mean, that people have to do that. It can't be done in China, can't be outsourced to China. So there's good jobs for people here in this area. There's more. In fact, there's new jobs. And one of the things of the roadmap bill is now in the law is that there will be clean energy training programs. But how do you install solar panels? How do you get into the wind industry, et cetera, et cetera? All these things. How do you retrofit homes to be more energy efficient? Like that is a huge. So that's at the Clean Energy Center, which is out on Route 9, I think in Weston. But I mean, there you go. So it's like you recognize that there's jobs there. You're providing training. That training should be equitably distributed so that people in every neighborhood get a chance to participate. And it's all good. I mean, and so that's those are many of the main points of this roadmap, this kind of sprawling legislation. It needs to be supported. There are deadlines in it. So maybe at some point I can pull together the deadlines. But by June of this year, that net zero stretch code is supposed to come out. Right. And so we need eyes on the governor's office to make sure that that actually happens. Right. So there's lots more work to be done, but the roadmap is a good foundation. And we should pay particular take note that Jeff Roy was instrumental in getting that passed. Right. He's on a very important committee, and good for him for helping to shepherd that thing through.
Yeah, at least in that current seat of the TUE, technology, no, telecommunications, utilities, and energy. Right.
Which is the weirdest combination of things to stick into one committee.
How it makes it a there, bad acronym too. Two.
Yeah, it's a terrible like acronym. And there's like people, and so dear listener, I mean, the TUE committee is very important. It's weirdly named, but it's where all the energy and climate legislation goes through. Whatever historical thing where they all got lumped together, but mm-hmm. the TUE is an important place.
Yeah. The buzzword State House will be another opportunity. We'll talk about that some other time. Well, thank you for spending some time to tackle this list, because I think now we've got certainly much more of a comfort. At least I have a little bit more sense in terms of what climate challenges there are. And clearly this is somewhat legislated, somewhat problematic or programmatic in terms of having milestones specifically set. There are still some aspirational pieces in it, but those are going to get worked. Bottom line, while the legislation is there and there may be enhancements to the legislation, there is a boatload of work still to be done to make this happen. To your point, just keeping an eye on it, making sure the governor does what else he needs to do by January. There's a whole host of other things along that line. So yeah, thanks for helping to make some sense of this. And I'm sure we'll continue the conversation because as we've started talking, there's so many other ways we can go.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of interesting topics to think about.
So for the Franklin listeners, if you have any questions, send them along. My info's all over the place. We'll include that in the show notes as well. And if you've got any particular climate area questions or any Franklin specific questions, by all means, include them and we can try to tackle them in a future episode. And again, thanks, Ted, for taking some time today. And just a quick reminder, we do this because Franklin matters.
We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. By the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.